then 25 on Wednesday night, and then 26 today. This is the third chapter in a short series of three where Paul makes a defense or a speech before three different people, primarily before three different people. The first person in Acts 24 was who? Felix. Then when he left his, or was replaced by Nero. Second speech last Wednesday was before Festus. Now today's speech, as we learned from the end of class last time, Festus put Paul's case before somebody, and this person today said, I'd like to hear what he's got to say, and that is Agrippa, Herod Agrippa II. Brother Bowen asked a question Wednesday night about which Caesar this is, and I did a little research, and this, from all indication, this is Nero that we're talking about. Augustus was a name that was commonly used by a lot of the emperors, just like the word or the name Caesar was also. It just didn't refer to one emperor. So this is Nero that Festus must send Paul to with this letter. So there's that little bit of information. All right, as we begin chapter 26, Paul is given permission to speak. As you see, the first verse, just in a show of some sort of formality or some sort of orderliness in this assembly in the auditorium, Agrippa nods his head and Paul is given the floor, so to speak. And so as his defense before this man begins, he starts in verse 2, and really you can go from verse 2 to verse 23. That is Paul's speech. So we'll outline it, we'll break it apart in those areas. Verses 2 through 3. What is the first sort of thing that Paul talks about? He didn't really get to his case just yet. What does he say? All right. I am happy. I'm delighted. This version reads in verse 2, I consider myself fortunate. Now, we made, and I've asked the question here at the end of question 1, back in chapter 24, when Paul was before Felix, who was the first person to speak back there? Do you remember? It was that lawyer, Tertullus. And one of the things that we mentioned about it, as we characterized his early words, he sort of laid it on pretty thick before Felix, buttered up the emperor. Oh, not the emperor, the governor. Is that what Paul's doing here? That would not be Paul's character. And so I want us to be clear that we didn't see Paul saying what he's saying here in the same way that Tertullus said back to Paul. That lawyer was a politician, and that's how you get things done, is you sort of grease the egos of those who you're standing before. But Paul's just simply saying, I'm grateful to have Agrippa hear this case, and the reason why he gives is what? Yes, he knows something about Jewish customs. In fact, most versions read, this version uses the word expertise or expert. You're an expert in all the customs and questions among the Jews. As was made mention Wednesday night, why was Agrippa considered somewhat of an expert? No, Agrippa. That was Felix. Felix had married a Jewess, that's right. But why is Agrippa, why does Paul consider Agrippa somewhat of an expert? Yes, he's from Idumea, or an Edomite. And the Herods, for the most part, they were not faithful Jews. I mean, they did not live. Herod is living with his sister. He's involved in incest. So he's not a moral man by any stretch of the imagination. And neither was his father, Agrippa 1, from Acts chapter 12. But all the Herods, the Herodian family, they observed in some respects, they observed the Jewish customs and some respects of the law. Looking at these three men that Paul has stood before, Felix first, and then Festus, and Herod. Felix knew what he knew simply because why? His wife was a Jewess. Okay, what did Festus know about the law? And Paul said he knew nothing about it. Now Herod, he's standing before Herod's got some idea. He's got some understanding of Paul's background, and so Paul says, "I'm thankful." to stand before you and make my case. This doesn't bother me at all. It's not like the deck is stacked against me. It's the Jews who are accusing Paul. Someone may think, well, if it's the Jews who are accusing Paul and standing before a man who knows the Jewish customs, that seems like that's kind of one-sided. No, Paul didn't say it that way. Paul's grateful for this chance to stand before Herod. This is a perspective Festus did not possess. And so that's why Paul is thankful that that's working out the way that it is. Okay, now, having made that somewhat of an opening statement, that's through verse 3. Now, question 2, verses 4 and 5. What does Paul reference? What does Paul bring up before Festus? All right, his early life. His prior conduct. All right, and the ones who were accusing him, they knew this, didn't they? What does Paul say about himself in these two verses? Things like what? All right, I'm a Pharisee. According to the strict adherence of the Pharisaic traditions, These Jews know that, all right? And does he stress anything else? All right, yes? Right, and he's going to mention that in verses 6 and 7. That's correct, yeah. But the thing that struck me in verse 4 is these Jews know. I mean, I'm not sitting up here saying things that they've never heard before. They know how I used to be. And in fact, Paul's previous manner of living, it would have agreed with where they are, with how they're accusing him. So he has been where they are now. And he says, they know that. This isn't anything strange to them. So he admits that. Paul had been just like them. But now he mentions in verses 6 and 7, he again mentions this hope of the resurrection. We've seen it in chapter 23 and chapter 24, where Paul mentions this, has mentioned this several times. This is how I used to be through verse 5, now verse 6. And now I am standing trial for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers. There's that promise again. And we understand that to be referencing what promise? Way back where? Who did God first make promise to? Abraham, Genesis chapter 12. All the way back there, those three promises concerning the still non-existent Jewish nation, but that would eventually come from Abraham's seed, but more importantly, the seed promise, not the land or the nation promise, but the seed promise. Verse 7, the promise to which our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly serve God night and day, and for this hope, O King, I am being accused by the Jews. So, Paul's not changing his message. He's staying on theme. And again, notice, as we said, before the Jews in chapter 22, before Festus in 24, Felix in 24, before Festus in 25, Paul's not really going to talk about himself. He's using this as a platform to preach the gospel, talking about the promise that God had for his people. So, he mentions again his hope of the resurrection. As we remember that's how he divided the Sanhedrin when he stood before them, the Sadducees and Pharisees in the council chamber. And that one statement, I am on trial for my hope in the resurrection from the dead, and split that company right in half. So he's still mentioning that promise of the hope of the resurrection. Now, look at his question in verse 8. And I think this is rather interesting. After he mentions that this is why I'm on trial, what's the question that Paul asks in chapter 8, or verse 8? Now, why is this so far-fetched to some that God can raise the dead? Would it have been far-fetched, this idea of the resurrection, was it far-fetched to the Pharisees? We know it's not, because what did they believe in? They believed in the resurrection. Yes. Now, would it have been far-fetched to the Sadducees? Yeah, because they denied that. They didn't believe in that. But to part of the Jewish audience, this isn't really something that, what in the world is Paul talking about? No, they believed in the resurrection. But why are they against Paul? It's not because of the general idea of a resurrection. Why are they opposing him? That's it. The resurrection of Christ. That's the problem. They don't mind the general idea, oh yes, there's going to be a resurrection. But Paul had been preaching. And just to go back real quickly, the Pharisees did believe in the resurrection, 23 and verse 8. But let's go back to chapter 25. This was when Paul stood before Festus. And as Festus was laying Paul's case before Agrippa. And remember now, Festus, this is just all foreign to him. He doesn't get any of this because he's a pagan. But what did he say, about this disagreement that Paul had before his Jewish accusers? How did he summarize it? Chapter 23 and verse 19. What had Paul been talking about? Yeah, he said, there's no civil problem here. But what the Jews are mad about is that Paul, their points of disagreement with him about their own religion and about a certain dead man, Jesus, whom Paul said what? Well, he's alive. That's the sticking point. So this question that Paul asks in 26 and verse 8, why is it considered incredible that God can raise a man from the dead? They were so opposed to Paul's teaching because Paul was preaching a resurrected Christ. Not just a resurrected anybody, or generally speaking, but a resurrected Jesus. And that's always been the sticking point with the Jews, hasn't it? Let's just for one brief moment, let's go back and prove that. Go back to the early chapters of Acts. We want to look at chapter 4 and verse 10. It's been a long time since we've studied Acts chapter 4, it seems like, in these studies. But this will refresh our memories. When Peter and John healed the lame man in chapter 3, and then they began to preach, and the Jews called them into question. Chapter 4 and verse 10. Well, let's look in verse 9. If we are on trial today for a benefit done to a sick man, as to how this man has been made well, let it be known to all of you and to all the people of Israel that by the name of Jesus Christ, Nazarene, whom you crucified, then what did Peter say? Who God raised up. By this man, or by this name, this man stands here before you in good. And of course, Paul wasn't there that day. This is Peter. But it's still the apostles all preach the same doctrine. So they were preaching it from the start. Then chapter 5 and verse 28, when the Jews called them into question, and they ordered them to stop their preaching, remember, in chapter 4, later on, the apostles would not be intimidated. The council calls them back in. Chapter 5, verse 28, and the council said basically what? We told you, we gave you strict orders. You need to knock this off, because how did the council see it? You're filling all Jerusalem with your doctrine, and specifically, you're bringing this man's blood upon us. They didn't. That's always been the problem. And so then we see the response, verses 30 through 32, that Peter said, again, the God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom you had put to death. He is the one whom God exalted to his right hand. And then verse 32, we're witnesses. So that's always been the problem. So this question Paul asks, why is it incredible to you? Well, if you were just talking about the resurrection in general, the Pharisees would have had no problem with that. But their problem is the resurrected Christ. And of course, that's at the heart of all the gospel message, resurrected Jesus Christ. Okay, so that's the question Paul asks. Now, the big bulk of his speech, verses 9 through 18, what does Paul go over again? He's talked about his former manner of living, how the Jews knew that. He talked about, when I'm on trial for the hope of the promise that God gave our fathers. And then starting in verse 9, what does he cover again? His conversion, or the events going up to his conversion. That's right. This is the second time that Paul has recounted this. Of course, the record's in Acts 9. That's where we first read that. And then in Acts 22, the first time Paul reviewed his conversion, or those events leading up to his conversion, who was he standing before in chapter 22? Do you remember? It was the Jews, that audience of Jews in Jerusalem. He went through it again. Now he's before Agrippa. So he's going to go over this one more time. And the events, of course, they're the same as in chapter 9 and in chapter 22. And we've been through that already, so we won't take the time to go through this. We've studied it previously. But again, Paul just retells the story, how he's on the road to Damascus, and the vision of the Lord appeared to him, and they had that conversation, and Christ gave him the instructions to go into Damascus and be told you what you must do. Paul does not mention someone in this retelling of it. Now, he did so in chapter 22. Who's not mentioned here? Who helped Paul? Ananias is not mentioned here. We read about Ananias in chapter 9, and then also in chapter 22, Paul talks about that, but he doesn't mention him here. So this is the second time Paul tells it. And then he says in this, his early activities, not only he wasn't buying Christianity, he wasn't supporting it, but he did his level best to stop it, to try and halt it. Verses 9 through 11, again, he says, I did many things hostile to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. That's verse 9. And this is just what I did in Jerusalem. I locked up many of the saints in prison. When they were being put to death, he says, I cast my vote against them. And then verse 11 set the stage for his trip to Damascus, as he then tells the story. His receptiveness of Christ, he was willing to listen. The Lord spoke with him, verses 12 through 18. He retells those events. And I ask a couple of specific questions here that I want to spend a little bit of time on. Since we've been through this before, I thought it would be good for us to talk about these couple of points to see what we can learn from them. The phrase, when Jesus is having this conversation with him, what do we find in the end of verse 14? What did Jesus say? Yeah. It is hard for you to kick against the pricks, the old King James says, or against the goads, other later versions say. Now, if you use the New King James, the Old King James, you'll see this phrase in chapter 22. And I said when we went through that chapter that this was not in the original text. So that's why we did not deal with it then. This of the three chapters, chapter 9, where this took place actually, and then Paul retells it in chapter 22, and then here in chapter 26, this is the only place where this phrase actually occurs in the original text. That's why we saved it until now. So I want to talk about this just for a moment. When he says, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads. What I asked here, this is the end of question three. Let's be able to explain this phrase. What did Jesus mean when he said, it is hard for you to kick against the goads? What does that mean? All right. Okay, it was a prodding instrument used by farmers, shepherds, if you will, for animals. Now, this is such a quaint phrase. How easy would this be for non-agricultural people to understand? We wouldn't get this at all. You used the word maybe goad. I'm going to goad somebody into doing something. That's what a goad is. It's a prodding instrument. Well, what did it look like? I trying to find a picture, and I couldn't find one on the internet, so I was going to help us out there. But, all right, it was a stick or a pole, but it had a sharp point on it. And in many cases I've read, the tip was iron. It wasn't just whittled to a point, but it was an iron spike. And that was on the end of the stick or the pole, the instrument. And also I read somewhere where some goads or prodding instruments have that iron spike on the end, but it also had spikes on the sides, up and down the shaft of the pole. It was a pretty wicked-looking thing. Well, the animal's not doing what you want it to, whether it's the oxen that's pulling the plow or the wagon or whatever the animal's doing. It's got a mind of its own, so the farmer says, well, we'll have to just help this animal along, won't we? And so you poke it, you prod it. Well, what's the animal going to do? Well, it'll eventually move, but it might be inclined to do what? Kick back against that goad. Now, what would that kicking against the goad indicate from? And I'm trying to get into the mind of the animal here. Yeah, I don't think I care for that too much. It was a gesture of resistance. But what good does it do to kick against the goad? Literally speaking, if you're that animal. Which, yeah, it's going to hurt worse to kick against that instrument than if you just do what you're supposed to do. Now, that's the idea. So now, how was Paul kicking against the goad here? This is obviously, we moved from the literal to the metaphor. He's persecuting Christians. You're right, Brother Miller. And he said, in his own words, he said, "I thought it that I would do many things hostile to the name of Christ. And I went and sought out his people. And I put them in prison. And I cast my vote against them when they were being put to death. And I really thought this is what I need to be doing." And really, what was he doing? He was kicking against the goads. Who was he hurting? He was hurting himself. You can't stop the way of Christ. You can't do it. Does it make any sense to fight against the will of God? In fact, we've had a Jew in these studies, have we not? A Pharisee. What was his name? Gamaliel. Remember when the apostles were brought before the Sanhedrin again? And they wanted to really, they wanted to kill him. And what did Gamaliel say? Just, you can summarize it. You better leave it. If this is of men, it'll go away to nothing. But if it's of God, you can't fight this. See, it's useless to kick against the goads. Useless. And that was the question, it was the statement that Jesus had for Paul. You're doing yourself no good. In fact, you're only hurting yourself. Now, can we do anything with that today? I know we're not out here hunting people down, trying to kill them. But is there any ways that today that we can be found guilty of kicking against the goads? Well, I would say so. Whatever part of your life that the gospel of Christ addresses, whether it's your moral behavior or your literal behavior in terms of what you wear, what you drink, or what you speak, or what you say, where you go, all those issues. What if we constantly fight that? What if we constantly show a resistance to what the will of Christ says? What are we doing? Aren't we kicking against the goads? I think we are. And who are we hurting? We're only hurting ourselves. That's all we're going to do is wind up hurting ourselves in the end. Because Christ has said, "It's my word that will judge all of you." And there's no sense in fighting it. Paul was doing it literally in this case. And Jesus said so. Don't kick against the pricks. Don't kick against the goads. It will not do you any good. I think that's a great application for us that we need to think about very seriously. Any comments or questions anybody has? Yes. Yes. If you ignore your own conscience, and of course, if your conscience is leading you in the right way, of course, Paul's was not, but he changed. But if the conscience is leading you in the way that God wants you to go and you go against that, yes. That would be a way of kicking against the goats. Very good point, Daniel. Brother Bowen? Yes. Paul didn't have to be put to death, but he was certainly in agreement with it. And so Stephen and every other persecuted saint that he encountered, I think that's a good point, were metaphoric goads that Paul kept trying to step by step, person by person, trying to undo the way of Christ. Yes, Albert. He was at it wholeheartedly. You're right. That verse where he says that he was enraged or furious. What verse is that? Verse 11. Yes. Yes, exceedingly furious or furiously enraged. That's right. Paul, he was in it all the way. And so he was not half-hearted. That's a good point. Okay, so there's this lesson within this chapter that Jesus said to Saul at the time. That was his name. But we can be guilty of the same thing if we're not careful. So that's good for us to talk about. Okay. There's these points about the kicking against the goat. He's only hurting himself. Another thing I wanted to talk about was in verses 14 and 15. This is at the bottom of the page, page 135. After Jesus said to, it was before, when he said, it is hard for you to kick against the goads. A statement that is before that and then verse 15 after it. When he appeared to Saul on the road, Saul asked the question, "Who art thou?" And what did Jesus say? I am Jesus who you're persecuting. And then he says, the question was, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And notice that the emphasis Jesus is making, who was it that Saul was persecuting? I mean, literally. He was going after Christians. But the point I'm making is, what did Jesus say about it? You're doing it to me. What does that tell us? Does that tell us anything? Christians are of Christ. They're wearing His name. That is true. Does that tell us what Jesus thinks about it? He takes it personally. Any parent, if someone does something to your child, well, you're not going. That's not good, obviously. What are you going to think about that? Are you going to take that personally? Yeah, that's how you'll feel about it. And so we can relate with that sentiment. In Matthew 25, and I put this on the chart. I didn't put this on the piece of paper in your lesson sheet. In the parable of the judgment scene, after Jesus has, when he commends the sheep on his right hand for doing what they did, and then the goats on his left, I'm using particularly the words to the rebellious on his left, when he says that you didn't do these things, how did Jesus phrase it there? Inasmuch as you didn't do it to the least of these, you didn't do it to me. And I think there's a lesson for us there. Jesus takes the treatment of His saints personally. And so, when we're the object of someone's ire, or we're the object of someone's ill treatment, we can take comfort in the fact that Jesus is aware of that. He's aware of persecution, and He knows that you're His disciple, and He takes it very personally. And so that is the way that he phrased it to Paul on that occasion, and that can give us some level of comfort. It needs to anyway. That's how we should look at that. Okay, that's down through verse 15 as Paul was recounting this. Then he says basically what role it was that God had in mind for Paul. Yes, Paul had been a great persecutor. But here's the things that I want you to do. Arise, stand on your feet. For this purpose I have appeared to you to appoint you a minister, a servant. And what else? A witness. All right. He's a first-hand witness. Not only to the things which you have seen, that is, there that day on the road, but also to the things which I will appear to you. I will show you more of these things. And then verse 17, I'm going to deliver you from the Jews and from the Gentiles to whom I am sending you. Purpose of gospel preaching. These words were said to Saul, but Acts 26, verse 18 kind of summarizes the purpose for preaching. Yes, Bob is telling us that these words in verses 16 through 18, when Paul, of course, this is saying being said after the fact, but when Paul went through all those trials and persecution we've already studied in previous chapters, he would remember these words of Christ, and that's what helped him put one foot in front of the other every day, keep pressing on. Paul was to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light and from the domain of Satan to God in order that they may receive forgiveness of sins and an inheritance among those who have been sanctified by faith in me. Paul, that's your work. Preaching the gospel will do what Acts 26 and verse 18 states. Open people's eyes to truth, and the receptant or receiving of that truth or the reception of that truth will deliver one from the domain of Satan, power of darkness, into the kingdom of the Son of Christ. So that's the role that God had for Paul. Verse 18 again is the purpose of preaching. Now, he then explains the vision, if you will, verses 19 and 20. Paul says, now, Agrippa, I did not prove what? Disobedient. Paul recognized this was something to obey. This was something that I had to do. It required my obedience. Again, he doesn't say here what took place, but what were the instructions that Jesus gave to Saul on the road? That's for us in Acts 9 and Acts 22. Go into Damascus, and it will be told you what you will have to do. And again, that's when Ananias comes into play. He does not mention this chapter, but that's who assisted Paul with his obedience. But he says, I didn't prove disobedient. But verse 20, he says, this now would be after his conversion. What did Paul do? I kept declaring to who? Both to those in Damascus first, then Jerusalem or Judea, and then finally, everywhere I've been. That's what I've been doing. My initial efforts to preach the gospel in Damascus, then I was sent to Jerusalem, or I escaped to Jerusalem, then I had to escape there also. And then as we know, that's when the journeys eventually started, and Paul on all his trips, all his preaching. He was doing what Jesus said to do. He was proving himself to be obedient to this divine commandment, if you will. And now Paul's going through all this to get to this point now, verse 21. So, he says, this is how all that took place. That's how it connects to right now. I finally get back to Jerusalem, and he says, what did the Jews do? All right, he says, they seized me. For this reason, some Jews seized me in the temple and tried to put me to death. That takes us back to chapter 21, when, remember, he was taking that vow in the temple, and they arrested him, they apprehended him, and that's what led to all these events that they've taken place the last three or four, five chapters. And that's why I'm here today. And he says, the concluding statement, this is how he summed up his speech here, the gospel and salvation for both Jews and Gentiles has been declared by the prophets. So again, Paul is preaching the gospel. So having obtained help, this is verse 22, from God, I stand to this day testifying both to small and great, stating nothing but what the prophets and Moses said was going to take place, that the Christ was to suffer, and that by reason of His resurrection from the dead, there's that point again. Paul does not leave that unsaid. By His resurrection from the dead, He should be the first to proclaim light both to the Jewish people and to the Gentiles. It's a great speech. He covers a lot of ground. Says a lot of things thematically that he's been saying all along in his preaching. No different message whatsoever. Now, you get the idea from verse 24 that Festus sort of interrupts him? I get that idea. What does Festus say? Paul, you are crazy. Festus had heard enough. Much learning has made thee mad. You are out of your mind. But again, that tells us Festus had no point of reference in all this material. He had nothing. He didn't have any knowledge of this at all. He's a Roman. But Festus saying this, what did Paul say right back to him? Well, he says, I'm not mad. I'm not crazy. What's his proof? To Festus, he says, here sits Agrippa. He knows what I'm saying is true. Now, that does not mean that Agrippa is a Christian. He's given amen to Paul's. No. But these things about the mention of the prophets, the resurrection of the Christ or of the Messiah, that's all mentioned in the Old Testament Scripture. And the Herods somewhat knew, the Old Testament Scriptures. And so Paul's defense is, no, I'm not mad. I'm offering as proof here, here's Agrippa. Notice what he says in verse 26. For the king knows about these matters, and I speak to him with confidence, since I am persuaded that none of these things escape his notice. Why, Paul? The end of verse 26. They're not done in a corner, in the back dark corner somewhere that nobody or just very few have heard about. Oh no, they're well known, and Agrippa knows them too. So I'm not mad, Festus. I'm not out of my mind. I'm not crazy, so to speak. Well, Paul's personal exhortation to Agrippa. What did he ask him? Do you believe? He says, King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you do. Paul is, he's supposed to be defending himself. He's being charged. And what's he doing? He cares more for who? Agrippa's soul than he does his own right now, his own personal freedom. I tell you, what a character. What a great spiritual character. He says, Agrippa, do you believe? I know that you believe. What did Agrippa say? You almost persuade me, the old King James says, or in a short while. Some actually make this a question. In a short while, would you make me a Christian also? Now, someone says, well, was he sincere in that or not? Well, we weren't there, and even if we were there, we couldn't see Agrippa's heart. We wouldn't know one way or the other. But knowing what we know about Agrippa's morality, what kind of man was he? Well, he wasn't much of a man, morally speaking. Could he have been sincere in this? Only God knows that. And maybe we shouldn't be so harsh to judge him one way or the other. But his response at least seems to me that he would not be so carried away by Paul's presentation here. The Herods and Agrippa, particularly, and his father like him, they cared more about political aspirations than they did about salvation of their souls. And that's just a statement of historical fact. Can anybody be reached with the gospel? Well, obviously, yes, they can. But the fact that the way this chapter ends, after he says this statement back to Paul, did Agrippa show any more interest in the gospel message? Really, he didn't. He didn't want to talk about it anymore. In fact, he wants to discuss now more Paul's release from custody than he does about what Paul has said to him directly or pointedly. So I don't think that he was very sincere in his statement. I could be wrong about that, and I'm not going to be so harsh on him, but I'm going to be dogmatic about it. But it seems to me the statement is just a kind of way to get out of Paul's... I mean, Paul has got him cornered with his statement. And he's maybe trying to deflect some of that now for other purposes. Charles, your hand up. Okay. I can accept that. Paul's response, whether in a short time or a long time, I would that all men were as I am, except, of course, for these bonds or these chains. Maybe I'm being too harsh on Agrippa. I don't know. I'll just leave it at that. But nonetheless, that is Paul's statement. If we look at it all together, again, we see Paul is being consistent in how he's being treated in all these judgments, if we can call it that. He spends more time preaching the gospel, talking about the need of salvation, talking about the promise from God to the fathers, than just about gaining his own personal political freedom. And that's one thing that I want us to be focused on. Yes, Norm? So far, yeah, that's a good point. It's not up to us to pick and choose. We just got to preach the gospel. And a person can be so far depraved, well, they'll never listen. Well, how do we know? I mean, we just got to teach the truth and let the chips fall. That's a good observation. He did tell Agrippa what needed to be said. Okay, well, following this exchange, again, Paul hoped that whether in short or a long time, all men would become as he was, except for these bonds or these chains. Well, following this speech, Agrippa, Festus, and Bernice, thank you, they kind of get up and they go off to the side to privately confer. Now, again, as we made mention, what is Festus hoping for in this little session? I want something to put on paper because Paul's going to Rome. And so they get up and they talk. And what does Agrippa say, basically? Yeah, this man has done nothing deserving death or even imprisonment. And then Agrippa says what to Festus personally? Yeah, he'd have been turned loose except that he's already appealed to Caesar, and you can't undo that. So that's going to happen. So. The last point I want to make is, what do we think Festus thought when this concluded? I didn't get any help. This hasn't helped me one bit. Most likely he was somewhat disappointed with how this had played out. So that ends Paul's defense. And as we'll pick up Wednesday night in chapter 27. Festus, well, once Paul had appealed to Caesar, that's it. But before that took place, Festus could have released him. He had the right to do that. But not as this, as the issue stands now. Paul's going to Rome. That can't be undone. Okay. Thank you for your good comments, and we'll.